Tune it in, check it out, listen up, find out what it is all about.
Welcome, this is Matthew Bronson, and this is Conversations with Matthew Bronson on KUPR 99.9 on the FM dial in the high desert of Placidas, New Mexico. And today, conversation is with Jim Fish. If you've traveled through here or lived here long enough, you know about Anasazi Winery. And that is only one of the, what I'm going to predict, is fascinating things that we're going to learn about Jim Fish, who I am told will comfortably go by Fish. So welcome to the program.
Thank you.
If you had, like, a sentence to tell someone, like you go to a, I was going to say a cocktail party, you'd go to a wine party, and you meet someone, and they go, well, what do you do, Jim? What would you say?
I'm the winemaker for Anasazi Fields Winery in the historic village of Placidas.
And how long or how many drinks would I have to have with you before you would talk about being a PhD in chemical engineering from Princeton or a long career at Sandia Labs or your poetry, the book you've written? Was it Gemini because you're a Gemini?
Right.
Kind of rhymes, doesn't it? Gemini, I'm a Gemini. So there's a lot of things you've done.
Right.
Because you've just lived so long.
That's right.
But is it, you talk about the winery because that is what's in front of you right now?
That is usually the jumping off point. And then the other things follow as appropriate. The winery is what I live and breathe. The other aspects of my life support the winery.
Well, at what point in your life did you know that when I'm done with the career that's going to make the money to let me do what I want to do, which is why a lot of people work 30, 40 years, was it like year two you said, and this is all done, I'm going to get me a winery?
No.
I don't say that because you're from Texas. But
The winemaking started out strictly as a hobby. I like big, complex red wines. I was seeing fruit go to waste in Placidas. I was seeing people cutting down fruit trees because they didn't want this mess in their yard.
Right.
And I said, oh, I can make wine out of this.
Here's the first key point about the Anasazi Winery. Because we talked a little bit about this before. All right, you said that you like, I feel like a Clarence Darrow, you said that you like complex red wines.
Correct.
Like a Cabernet Sauvignon, something like that.
Yes.
Yet you started with apricots. You were never going to get there with fruit.
Not true.
Not, wrong again. Jack Hughes.
The apricot wine that we make has the complexity, is food friendly, and has all of those, that broad spectrum of aroma, taste, finish, shelf life, aging characteristics of a big red wine.
Is there any characteristic between the two that I was correct in saying that it's not like a complex red wine, or I was 100% wrong?
100%.
All right. I guess I just haven't tried enough of your wines.
So with a grape wine,
right,
you have a spectra of flavor, aroma, finish, whatever, you know, all of those characteristics. With a well-made fruit wine, you have the same level of complexity, but on just a different spectrum.
Okay.
So, and there are overlaps. So, our cherry wine, you will find notes in the cherry wine that you would find in, say, a Syrah grape wine. You will have people say that a Syrah has a hint of cherry.
Right.
Our cherry wine has a hint of Syrah.
Ah.
So there's a crossover there.
Now, do I have to have a subscription to Wine Entrepreneur to really enjoy the wines you make?
No, in fact, it would steer you down the wrong path because they have a very limited concept of what wine is. And even in the grape wine world, they have a very limited concept of the grape wines. There's a lot more grape wines out there that are of interest than what they would talk about.
Is that just merely because the man is controlling the market?
That's right.
I got one right. When we think of the more traditional wineries from, I guess, California or Argentina France now, and they seem to, if you got a square foot of dirt, someone's going to open a vineyard.
Right.
As we discussed earlier, is there a number of bottles a year you have to produce to qualify as a winery? Not necessarily legally, but more within those in the know.
There's a complete spectrum of size of wineries. From the small boutique wineries in California, you'll have some traditional grape wineries that are no bigger than we are,
right,
that are known internationally. And then you have the big guys, you know, the commercial, industrial factory wineries.
Mm-hmm.
Many of the smaller wineries have been and are continuously being bought up by the big guys.
Like so there's most of the agricultural industry.
There's a constant consolidation going on, and new little ones pop up, and then they eventually get absorbed.
Well, to that point, you know, within the industry, big anti-GMO everything. Do people who grow grapes need to worry about, and are they going to start advertising GMO-free heritage grape or heritage fruit wines?
Yes.
Does it exist, or it's gone without?
It's already happened.
Okay.
Yeah.
I usually about 5 years behind on stuff.
And one of our claims to fame is that we are all chemical free in our raising practices, and we do not add things to our wine that would be detrimental. We don't do sulfites, for example.
Right.
We don't do fining. We do very little filtering, so we keep the wine as natural as we possibly can.
Well, how important is filtering? Am I going to get a couple of seeds or some?
No.
No? Okay.
No. There will be some sediment in our older wines.
Sure.
There will be sediment in an older French wine as well. And we don't charge extra for that.
Okay.
So the wine doesn't really get good until it's thrown a little sediment in the bottle.
I just figured that was the cork deteriorating because I had kept it wrong.
It's some of those harsher acids are precipitating out, and then the wine is getting softer and smoother and more complex and more fruits coming forward, and you're losing some of that bite from these big, large organic acids that come from the pits and the skins, which are the natural preservatives and the natural antioxidants.
So again, I may not be right on the money, but I would think if you were farming, you're growing something, and then you're harvesting it, and you're storing it, and then making something into it, those are all different elements of the chemical process where you end up in wine.
Right.
And that's, so were you able to take your previous professional career of balancing plutonium with kryptonite, did that really help you make your wine?
Absolutely. There is a lot of art in winemaking, but understanding some of the basic fundamental chemical processes, oxidation, fermentation is a chemical process. Photosynthesis is basically a chemical process.
Sure.
Much of my time at Sandia was spent in the solar energy program looking at possible chemical uses of solar energy, direct chemical uses. photosynthesis is nothing more than a direct chemical use of solar energy.
Sure.
You're taking sunlight, you're taking various chemicals, oxygen, water. Mm-hmm.
The chlorophyll.
CO2, and you are making chlorophyll. So
right. Just as an aside with your solar energy chemical work, I think we might ever get to the point that you can, whatever you paint the outside of your house with is actually the solar collector.
I think that that's very viable, very possible.
So, cool.
Yeah. I mean, it's solar energy works.
Right. Because I've seen things on Science Channel where they, some kind of nano something infused into the paint, and you paint your wall, and that's your TV screen.
Right.
That's coming too.
Yeah.
Right after the flying cars.
In some sense, petroleum is nothing more than stored solar energy. It's from plants that were grown in sunlight.
Are we going back to the old potential energy, turning it into kinetic energy? So when you were firmly committed to the winery and making wine, did you have to become like a sommelier? Did you have to go to Lyon, France, or California?
No.
You don't get to wear that little silver cup?
No.
Okay.
No. Like I say, it was a hobby.
Right.
There was no intention to go commercial. It just happened.
But at that point, you didn't do... Okay. No.
It's been a kind of an organic process.
All right.
And, you know, I wake up one morning and I'm in deeper than I ever intended to be, and there's no way out. So you got to figure out how to make it work.
And you'd say it's working.
It's working.
How many varieties do you produce currently?
We have too many different wines.
Okay.
We do.
Whose fault is that?
Huh?
Whose fault? Okay. Mine.
Because I can't help. I'm an experimental chemical engineer, so I'm always experimenting.
Right.
And so if there's a new fruit, we just released a new wine that we call Nopalito that is 100% prickly pear.
Okay.
So.
And is Nopalito, well, that's noble, isn't it? Little noble?
Nopal is the Spanish word for prickly pear.
Nopal.
So Nopalito is the little prickly pear. And we sell it in little bottles, and it's fuchsia. It's beautiful. We float it on champagne and make this party in a glass. So
it's like your version of a tequila sunrise.
Right.
And, well, we weren't going this way, but so who decides the name? Do you?
I do, okay. Pretty much. I get
suggestions. This is not a democracy.
I am the board of directors. Not anymore. We've actually expanded.
I was a sole proprietor once, and I was such a bad boss, I would call a meeting and not even I would show up. So,
but going back to your question of how many wines we make, our basic, the fruits we grow in Placidas at Wild Cherry Farm are the wild cherries, apricots, peaches, plums, apples, domestic cherries, and that's kind of our base product. We also make a cranberry wine we get bulk cranberries from Ocean Spray.
Okay.
They come from Wisconsin typically. Right.
Did you meet those two guys on the commercials?
No. That is the only wine we make from non-New Mexico fruit. Then we make a grape wine from the three grapes. We do a field blend of the three grapes that we grow in Placidas and do one huge red wine we call Synesthesia.
Okay.
We also get bulk wine from St. Clair Wineries in Deming, Southwest Wines. We get bulk Syrah, and we get bulk Chardonnay, and a couple over the years we've gotten some other bulk wines from them. We take those bulk wines and we blend them with one of our old fruit wines to make what I call my gateway wines.
Okay.
Rojo Seco, for example, is one of those wines. It is a Syrah with 8% to 12% wild cherry.
All right.
this is a way for people to be introduced to the concept of a broader spectrum of flavor, etc.
Right.
Once people get kind of comfortable with that Syrah wild cherry blend, which is very familiar, very approachable, they don't have any trouble calling it a real wine.
Okay.
But it's got a twist to it. It's
sure.
Got that wild cherry. Then they want, whoa, well, what's, you know, the wild cherry? What does it taste like? It's a huge red wine, just mm-hmm. with no grape. And with venison, or duck, or rack of lamb, or chocolate, you put a bottle of Syrah, straight Syrah, and a bottle of wild cherry on the table, people are going to go for the wild cherry before it's over with, because it's got so much more interaction with the food.
So it, as they say, it pairs well.
It pairs beautifully with food and doesn't get blown away.
What about if I want a nice bloody piece of cow? Which of the Anastasi wines am I going for? Because I've always found, you know, a rare piece of beef with a Cabernet, mm-hmm. that they just go so well together in the mouth.
The wild cherry is a great one for that. The Rojo Seco is a very nice one for that. We also have done a Merlot blackberry blend that is a very nice red wine.
Okay.
We do a Chardonnay apricot blend that I call my red wine drinker's white wine, because it's got so much more complexity than a typical white wine.
I found that out decades ago when someone gave me a white Côte d'Aron.
Yeah.
Said that the label has to be wrong. It can't be. Yeah. And it was delicious.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, like with a grilled salmon, that mm-hmm. Blanco Seco, the Chardonnay apricot, is so much better than any white grape wine you could buy, any just pure grape wine.
Now, I don't mean this in any negative way, but you're buying some of these bulk wines to, produced at other wineries outside of the state.
No,
inside. Of the in-state, okay.
Yeah, all New Mexico.
At what percentage has to be local for you be able to say this is an Anastasi wine?
When we take the bulk wine, we blend it with one of our old fruit wines. We put it in the cellar on oak for 2 years, and because we have changed the class, we have cellared it, we have bottled it, it then becomes our wine and not their wine.
So you can actually take a wine and add value to it.
Absolutely.
It's like I can take ice cream and make it so much better with milk chocolate syrup. Okay, now we've got it in terms that even I can understand. Yeah. So when you buy the bulk wine, how many gallons is this?
We
come in one of those train cars?
No. It's what's called a space box, holds 275 gallons.
Okay.
And we'll get two or three of those at a time. And I rent a truck from Ryder and go down to Deming. And
do they have to be stored in a particular way?
No.
I'm thinking that I could get a couple people together and get about 250 gallons of Merlot, and I'll be way ahead of the game. I'm just not sure where I would put that.
Yeah.
So did we get to the part of how many bottles you produce a year?
We are currently we're in an expansion mode now.
Okay.
We're at about 3,000 gallons a year of what we're selling.
That's about 12,000 bottles?
15,000 bottles.
Okay. It's an old metric to gallons.
Well,
I was close.
A fifth of a gallon
is
750 milliliters.
Okay.
That's a standard wine bottle. That's where the fifth came from.
Right.
And so a fifth of Jack Daniels is 750 milliliters.
Okay.
A fifth of a gallon.
So it's like, what weighs more, a pound of lead or a pound of flour? Feathers. All right.
But we are currently working on going national with our cranberry wine through a program that Total Wines has called Winery Direct. And so we have had to convince them that we had the production capability to meet that demand if we did that. So we currently have 750 gallons of cranberry wine in our cellar ready to turn on to this market if it happens.
And when you say national, are we talking about like Whole Foods or Lowe's?
Well, Total Wines.
Total Wines.
That's big. They have 50 to 70 stores, I'm not sure exactly, scattered around the country.
Right.
Mostly southeast, east. And they have a program so that we don't have to go through a distributor. We can sell directly to them. We take the wine to the Albuquerque store, and then they send it out to select markets nationally.
And are you going to have a really souped-up label at that point?
No.
Or you're just gonna,
same label.
No limited editions that you are going to sign, like Jerry Garcia?
No.
No? Will they have, you know, like a gallery where you'll be there presenting the wine?
They do some marketing for us. They help us with the marketing. And so there will be some opportunities to do wine tastings and introduction of the wines to customers.
Do you ever drink anything other than your own wine?
Absolutely.
So what's your everyday wine? Not that you drink every day, but I do.
My everyday wine is one of my wines, depending on what I'm having for dinner.
Okay.
But I love big red wines, and so I'm always on the lookout for a nice big red wine. I buy wine from the other wineries in New Mexico. I very seldom buy a wine at a wine store.
Right.
Or at the grocery store.
Sure.
I've got plenty of wine.
Yeah, I guess so.
and we do a lot of, the wineries do a lot of trading too. You know.
Sure.
You want a bottle of this, I'll have a bottle of that. So
you can play 750 mil poker. I'll raise you a Chardonnay. Besides being a winery up there, it is an amazing facility where the public can come and lots of things happen. Can you speak about that for a little bit?
We do poetry readings there. We do art shows. We do music events. We do winemaker dinners. We do belly dancing hoflas.
That's the royal we. You're not including yourself or myself.
No, I don't belly dance.
Okay.
No. We make the facility available to local groups for meetings or fundraisers. KUPR has done two fundraisers
right
at the winery.
The most recent one, Valentine's Day?
Yeah.
But it was mobbed.
Yeah. Yes, it was a very successful event.
And it's constructed largely out of logs? Or
right. It's post and beam construction.
And someone said that you built it?
Yeah, my partners and I pretty much did the construction. We had to get a commercial contractor to pull the permit.
Certainly.
But we did most of the work, the mechanical, the electrical. We brought in subcontractors to do that. But
and big old heaters in the ceiling for those chilly nights.
Yeah.
So you're 365-day-a-year operation.
Yeah, and we're working on buttoning it up to make that even more viable.
Right. So it is a work in progress.
It's absolutely a work in progress.
That sounds like fun. Where can people go, like on the internet or Facebook, to learn more about it and find out what events are coming up?
We have a website, AnasaziFieldsWinery.com.
Let's spell that just for...
A-N-A-S-A-Z-I.
Okay.
FieldsWinery.com.
Okay.
And the name comes from the fact that it was a cornfield 1,000 years ago by the same culture that was in the Four Corners. And so we refer to it as Anasazi Fields. There's petroglyphs above, on a ridge above the winery, that are very similar to the petroglyphs you find in the Four Corners area. The irrigation ditch, the acequia that we use,
right,
is over 1,000 years old. It wanders down through the village from the springs up above the village. And we have an archaeological friend of mine, archaeologist, did a a test dig of a little site we have there right on the ditch.
Right.
And we have absolute conclusive evidence that that ditch is over 1,000 years old. And that was a cornfield.
Mm-hmm.
We found the grindstones. We found the Manos and Matatis. And
no evidence of any extraterrestrial life at the winery.
No.
Okay. I just figure this place is thick with paranormal. I can't seem to pin it down. But it's a beautiful facility, and it is do you have a Facebook, did you say?
We do have a Facebook. Okay.
The reason I ask is, do you want interaction from the public?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So the best way would go to the Anastasi Fields,
winery.com,
and they can communicate with you that way, too.
Yeah.
Now, you are also an artist, but making the wine is an art, but you work in other mediums also.
Right. I do a lot of sculptures, mostly wood. Some wood, bone, stone, but I call myself a wood carver.
Okay. So you said you call yourself a wood carver.
Right. I've been whittling all my life, and that is a hobby that's now starting to get us out of control like the winemaking did. So
they have a nasty habit of doing that. But some of the pieces that are up there, I don't really consider whittling. They're large.
Yeah, I've done a lot of big pieces, and I've just started a new series of what I call wall sculptures.
Right.
To hang on the wall, so I could do a show down here.
Right, because we have walls.
Yeah, a lot of people have walls that don't quite know what to do with those large.
And you're going
to
help them out.
Farm. Yes.
Now, as I said there, you do have some, smaller...
My little critters, right. I call them.
But the big pieces, are you just wandering around and go, hey, there's a nice piece of wood, and drag it back?
Yes.
But,
or somebody will drag it back for me.
Okay.
And say, oh, look at this piece of wood I found. What can you do with that?
Kindling?
Yeah.
Well, what... If I'm wandering around, is there a way that I could learn to go, that is a perfect canvas upon someone who knew that they were doing could whittle or chainsaw?
Practically any piece of wood is a perfect canvas. You just can't go wrong with wood. It's beautiful. And if it's got any kind of complexity, a knot here, a twist here, then that just adds to it.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's why they have distressed furniture now. They take nice new furniture and beat it with chains and then charge you more for it. Go figure. But you've got the original. You've got God's distressing.
Absolutely.
On the wood.
Yeah.
Do you favor the big ones versus the small ones? Or
I love working big. The issue is I've filled up the space pretty much with big ones.
Right.
I need to do something else. Or I need to move some of those big pieces. And occasionally somebody will come in and buy a big piece.
When you see the raw wood, as it were, or actually, do you ever cut down something to have that wood, or you want it already dried and dead as could be?
Yeah, I mean, I would not cut down a live tree to get a piece of wood.
Okay.
Now, if it's a dead tree, if it's going to fall down,
sure,
I might harvest some of it, but I would not take a live tree and cut it down for wood. There's plenty of wood on the ground already.
And the wood on the ground around here, that's mostly pinyon juniper?
I do a lot with pinyon juniper. We've got all the fruit wood from the orchard, when we're doing prunings and stuff.
Right.
One of my big pieces is called Heart of Apricot. It came from a neighbor's apricot tree that had died. I'd made apricot wine from that tree before it died. And so I took a big limb off of it and made that carving called Heart of Apricot.
So that that limb, that piece of art, has a history.
Absolutely.
You knew it as a mere child.
Yes.
When you see the piece of wood, do you go, that's going to be a squirrel or something?
Typically,
when does it get defined that this is what it's going to be?
Typically, when I get a piece of wood, I have no idea what I'm going to do with it. And it may sit around for a couple of years, and I may see it and toss it aside. I may look at it. At some point, I jump into it, and I just see what happens.
Well, if you have a significant other, they're very understanding. I don't think I could get away with having some logs laying around the garage for a couple of years. I'm going to get to it, honey. I'm just waiting for inspiration.
I've got 3.5 acres around the winery.
Right.
And I've got wood piles scattered all throughout.
Oh, I thought you were just clearing the fields. That's actually your inventory.
That's my inventory. My potential pile.
Do you always use the same kind of wood carving tools?
I use everything from a chainsaw down to chisels, knives, Arbitech, which is a little grinder. I use a right-angle grinder with a chainsaw blade on it. I use Dremel tools.
I see no visible scars, and you appear to have 10 fingers, so
yeah.
You don't have to wear the special like shark gloves. And then most of them are buffed out?
And then it's just, ultimately, it's a lot of hand sanding. Right. You know, that's...
That's up there with one of my least favorite things. It's like cleaning chicken.
Yeah.
But I guess you can't get an apprentice to do that?
I haven't been able to yet.
Yeah, it's hard to find indentured servants. Yeah. No one wants to learn silversmithing anymore in Colonial Williamsburg. Is this all OJT?
You know, absolutely.
Read a book on carving?
When I was at Princeton,
right,
there was a professor of economics
that
was offering a class in wood carving. And
I see the connection.
And so I had been playing with wood all my life, and so I took his class. And
this was a class with credits?
No.
Okay. Princeton had slipped.
Yeah. And so I took a chunk of maple, and we used nothing but hand tools.
All right.
Chisels and rasp and sandpaper, etc. And I carved the piece I called Jim and I. And that a photo of that is on the cover of my book.
And that led to your
poetry called Jim and I. I was working on the poetry book at the time, and I wanted the sculpture to go with the book.
Is it unusual for someone very technically minded, you know, PhD, chemical engineer, to also write poetry?
I probably have some cross connections in the brain. So,
but your peers, were they going, Jim, be a man? What's with this poetry stuff? Didn't get a lot of that?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Okay. Is the book still in print? Is it available?
It is no longer in print. It was a limited production book, and I have pulled some of those poems into some of the newer collections, but...
Is it available at the Placidus Community Library from where we broadcast?
Jim and I is not, but
two
of my poetry books are.
But there is a volume available that,
for
if they ask,
to look at.
But if the library wanted a copy?
I might be able to find a copy for it.
Okay. You just have that. It's next to the woodpile. A few thousand copies there. I was reading, it might have been an interview you did in the Signpost or someplace, but you had spoken about, like in high school, that you took shop.
Right.
We're approximately the same generation. I know we go to the same barber. I was into music. I wanted to be in band and stage band and orchestra and all that. The people who took shop, I don't think any of them grew up to be chemical engineers. I could be wrong, but it was generally because they didn't know what else to do with these kids, so they gave them sharp objects to play with.
With me, it was an interest in woodworking.
Okay.
And so I took shop. I had, you know, they didn't ban me from taking shop, even though I was also focusing on science.
Right.
Even in high school. So,
any of your other science-minded high school friends taking shop with you?
Well, in that community, yes.
Okay.
There were some fabulous teachers in this little West Texas town, and they were quite open to broadening students.
Sounds like you lived in a more advanced community than I grew up in, just being more, allowing people to be more expressive, at least that way.
It was amazing. I mean, little West Texas town of Sonora, and it was just, and I was the first person to ever go to Rice University from there.
Okay.
But I had a science teacher that early on started pushing me in that direction. I had an English teacher that was encouraging writing. I had the shop teacher that was encouraging woodworking and creative woodworking, right, not just furniture building, standard stuff.
So, a birdhouse or a pencil box or whatever. That had to be, did you recognize what a wonderful environment you
I
were in?
I had no idea.
Okay, you thought everyone was like that.
Yeah, I got I got into the broader world and said, I was very lucky. Yeah. I was extremely lucky growing up in that particular
Absolutely.
Spot at that particular time.
So it seems to have worked out well. Yeah. I was just looking at my notes about some of the wood that you carve, and you had mentioned that I think your Princeton piece was maple.
Right.
I don't know if I saw a piece of dead wood on my hiking path that I could go, oh, that's maple, that's juniper, that's spruce. Did you have to learn that, or you just still took the piece you liked?
I take the piece of wood, and when I pick up a piece of wood, I'm not sure what it is sometimes.
Right.
Because it's weathered.
That's true.
It just looks like old wood. Once you start cutting into it and seeing the grain, the smells, then you can figure out what
right.
it is.
All right.
From experience. Right.
Let's go on to Placitas, because KUPR is a community radio station, and you've been here a long time.
Right.
But what year did you take up permanent residence in Placitas?
I moved here in May of 1981.
Not to the Albuquerque area, but to Placitas.
Straight to Placitas.
What in the world was here in 1981?
The village was here. There were a few houses in West Placitas West. There were a few houses in Rancho de Placitas. Tom Ash had started Rancho de Placitas.
Right. Did you know someone? I mean, how did you do?
I was working at Sandia National Labs, Livermore, wanted to transfer to Albuquerque because it was getting back to the country.
Right.
Country I was familiar with. And a friend of a friend said, oh, you should check out Placitas. And so I told my realtor I wanted to check out Placitas, and she said, oh, you're crazy. You want to go to Corrales, or you want to go to Cedar Crest, or, the northeast side. I said, no, I want to check out Placitas. So,
and was it a little rough when you went through the villages? Or is that picturesque?
It was a little country village, and it was very appealing.
Was there any commerce here? Could you have some place to go get milk for the baby at 2 o'clock in the morning?
Jake and Lizzie had their little store in Placitas where you could get milk. That was before the mini mart.
Right.
They had their little country store. Albuquerque is not that far away.
True.
So I had to go to Albuquerque every day for work anyway. I had to go all the way to the other side. So,
not much traffic.
And so I could find whatever I needed on the way home.
Right. Perfect. Well, are you, as a Placitas citizen, happy with the way everything progressed?
I absolutely love living in the village. I've always, from the very beginning, it was a magical place. It is a very creative community.
That's an understatement.
Yeah, and it's amazing, the creativity and the energy that you get from that creativity. It's been a wonderful. Yeah.
But many people comment that even if they're relatively new to Placitas, whether they're coming home from the south or from the north on 25, when they hit that 165 and head east, just about 100 yards past the recycling plant, people get this totally different whole body experience, no matter how many times they've done it. It's like, I'm here.
Right.
And yeah. Any idea what that is?
It's just a very comfortable landscape and a very inviting landscape. Right. And a very interesting landscape.
And as your career progressed and I'm going to assume made more money and stuff like that, you never wanted to go to one of these more expansive homes? It for you?
I like the Village.
People say that.
I love that agricultural connection.
Right.
And that's one of our main goals is to try to help maintain that agricultural nature of the Village and the rural.
Right. So, closing question, what is next for Jim Fish?
I am currently working on my second Taos book, and the first one was called Dancing the Snow, A Guide to Skiing for an Old Man. I'm now working on Dancing the Summer, A Hiking Guide to Taos Ski Valley.
For an old man?
No.
Anyone?
Anyone. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you've expanded your literary horizons. Well, Jim, it's been a pleasure. I hear the Anastasi Winery everywhere, all kinds of events I've been to there. And for some reason, every event I've been to there, and I've been at the winery for the last couple of years, you were off doing something else. So I never had an opportunity to meet you face to face. It's kind of interesting because when you know a lot about somebody, mm-hmm. but you've never met them, all I can say is that it hasn't disappointed. So I've had a great time. I hope you have too, and I hope everyone who listens to this on KUPR 99.9 FM will enjoy it also. And don't forget, you can go to kupr.org and learn more about the station. Most of my interviews end up on an archives page if you want to listen to them over and over again, or perhaps share them with someone who wasn't able to. And then we're always open 24/7 at kupr.org because we stream. So we're plugged in here. So again, for a conversation with Matthew Bronson, thank you. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.